not fear, the one and only Tucker Carlson. He's here, right now.
Buck up, it's going to get better.
Hello, welcome to Tuckered Out. I'm Troy.
I'm Tyler.
And this is a podcast where we're a couple of Sigma males who talk about beta male cuck Tucker Carlson.
True.
Yeah, if this is anybody's first episode, they're like, I'm gonna jump ship on this one, y'all. And rightfully so. We have anybody to thank today, Tyler?
We sure do, Troy. All right, we have C. David is just asking questions.
Well, thank you very much, C. David.
Yes, thank you, C. David. I appreciate the anonymized name so that I don't have to be trepidatious. And then, speaking of anonymized names, Chi Wizzle is a lying, smug, pompous groupthinker.
Thank you, Chi Wizzle.
Thank you, Chi Wizzle. And Fizz is a lying, smug, pompous groupthinker.
Thank you very much, Fizz.
And we have Mr. Krippendorf, who was a patron before, but they increased their pledge to elite tier.
Thank you, Blake.
Thank you, Blake. And that is everybody for this week. Thank you to all of our wonderful patrons every week and every day and every moment of our lives. We love you.
That sounded like something I would sing in church. Thank you every moment, every day.
Peace be with you.
Speaking of church, Tyler, we are here for our weekly worship at the altar of one Tucker Swanson McNear Carlson.
Take me to church, Troy.
No. refuse. So this week we are talking about we're in the nightly show. We're going over November 29th through December 1st. And I didn't want the nightly show to get too far behind us. And I didn't feel like talking about mold bug today. So we're going to get caught up.
I don't blame you.
On the week behind us. This week was mostly kind of a clunker, but there is some interesting stuff. And I think I found a new observation about Tucker's personality, I guess, his approach to the world that we'll talk about when we get there. But first, we've got to jump into Monday's show. This was November 29th, and there's some COVID news, so Tucker has to lie about it.
Good evening, and welcome to Tucker Carlson tonight. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Seems like a good time to reassess the holiday season, so let's think about COVID and where we are. The first confirmed case of the coronavirus in the U.S. appeared in a blood test on January 18th, 2020. It was in the state of Washington. That was almost 2 years ago. How have we done since? Well, look at the numbers. Compared to 2019, Americans now are poorer, more isolated, more physically unhealthy, more fearful and sadder than they have been in generations, maybe ever. Depression has skyrocketed. Church attendance has dropped in half. Cancer deaths are up dramatically. So is obesity, hypertension, diabetes, strokes among young people, suicide, drug and ODs. You name it, it's up. These in addition to countless other serious social pathologies. People are not having children, for example. Maybe most depressingly, a new study from researchers at Brown finds that children, kids born during the pandemic have, quote, significantly reduced verbal, motor, and overall cognitive performance. An entire generation slower.
Well, that was a lot of things.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm not loving the Thanksgiving energy.
Nope.
It's overwhelmingly negative.
Yeah.
So he listed off a lot of things here, and I do want to kind of take them one at a time, because some are true, but lacking context, and others are just incorrect. So,
The first one I got was church attendance. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's been going down since before 2020.
Yeah. Yeah. Tucker's going to take us to church. So the first thing he said was that people are poorer. And on that, he is correct. According to U.S. Census data, the official poverty rate in 2020 was 11.4%, which was up one percentage point from 10.5% in 2019. That's the first increase in poverty after five consecutive annual declines. it's not hard to imagine why that might be, given that there was that whole pandemic thing and massive economic fallout.
Yeah. No protection from the government, so thanks.
I mean, remember when Biden campaigned on a $2,000 stimulus check? Good times.
Yeah. And then it was a $1,400 stimulus check, and then it was no stimulus check. And yeah. Now everything is terrible.
Next up, you said we're more physically unhealthy than we were before the pandemic. And that's kind of hard to measure exactly what he means by physically unhealthy, but in the broad strokes, he's not necessarily wrong. According to the American Psychological Association, in a report published on March 11th of this year, they reported that since the start of the pandemic, 61% of adults have experienced undesired weight changes, with 42% reporting that they gained more weight than they intended. Of those, they gained an average of 29 pounds. The median amount gained was 15, and 10% had said they gained more than 50 pounds. So not a great sign. And again, not totally unsurprising when you're stuck inside.
Yes.
Tucker also said that Americans are more fearful than they were before the pandemic, which, again, is hard to measure.
Yeah, is that a survey question?
The closest that I found was a Verwell Minds Mental Health Tracker survey, where they found in the most recent installment that 40% of Americans said that they have worried about the future multiple times a week over the last month. And 36% said they're currently more worried about the future than they would normally be.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, I went back through some previous iterations of the survey, and it does seem like there's a there is a trend up since the start of the pandemic, which you can expect. It's not like super dramatic. I actually thought it would have been a bigger bump.
Well, things haven't gotten much better, even though the pandemic is starting to wane a little bit.
And I mean, we're an optimistic people, us Americans.
Maybe some of us.
And then Tucker said that we're sadder than possibly ever. I think what he's talking about there, if he has a source, is from the NORC at the University of Chicago and their COVID response tracking study. To quote from that study, "This bold yet surprising conclusion comes from the COVID response tracking study conducted by NORC. It finds that just 14% of American adults say they're very happy, down from 31% who said the same in 2018. Yikes. That year, 23% said that they'd often or sometimes felt isolated in recent weeks. Now, 50% say that. The survey was conducted in late May, and it draws on nearly a half century of research from the General Social Survey, which has collected data on American attitudes and behaviors at least every other year since 1972. No less than 29% of Americans have ever called themselves very happy in that survey. So since that data has been being collected, we are at a record low of Americans who describe themselves as very happy.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, it's not great. And like, we're still comparatively a pretty happy country compared to the rest of the world, which is astounding. Like, shit's fucked, man.
Yeah. We have sipped the Kool-Aid, as they say.
Next, he said that depression is up, and in that regard, he is correct. Depression among adults in the United States tripled in the early 2020 months of the pandemic, jumping from 8.5% pre-pandemic to 27.8%. Research from Boston University's School of Public Health reveals that elevated rate of depression has persisted into 2021, climbing to 32.8% and affecting one in every three American adults. From there, he said that church attendance has dropped by half. Half is an exaggeration, but church attendance is at a historic low. And that's a long-standing trend. It's been happening for decades. I think what he might be talking about with the half figure is that this year, religious affiliation fell below half the U.S. population for the first time. So that could be where he was pulling from.
Okay. Yeah. So he didn't read it at all. He just saw church attendance and half and then made a conclusion.
that's how he covers most news.
Yeah. It's still surprising that he gets away with it, though.
See, he said cancer deaths are up, and that seems sort of true. I found studies in both the Lancet and the BMJ that supported that conclusion, and essentially the reason seems to be that routine care that could lead to earlier cancer diagnoses have become less readily available during the pandemic, as hospital services were overwhelmed with COVID patients. So we saw a lot of checkups or elective care deferred, and that seems to have led to a certain amount of cancer cases that might have otherwise been detected earlier being found later, which results in an uptick in cancer deaths.
Okay.
He said that hypertension is up, which technically is correct, and that's following a well-documented 30-year trend and probably doesn't have much to do with COVID other than the associated weight gain.
Okay. I thought hypertension was like a stress thing too, but I'm not a doctor. I could be totally wrong about that.
No, I think you are right. He said strokes among young people are up, which, again, correlates with the longstanding trend. Strokes among young people have been steadily increasing for a while now, and that's almost certainly related to increased levels of obesity. It's still exceedingly rare for young people to have strokes, but the incidence of them has increased year over year for a while.
Which is not good.
And then he said suicides. This one is a little bit fuzzier. So overall, suicide rates have actually been down since the start of the pandemic. According to CDC data, suicides fell in the U.S. for the second year in a row in 2020. So the numbers dropped last year by 3%, including a substantial decrease in April amid lockdowns. That decline followed a 2% drop in 2019. So that's on the tail end of a consistent increase in suicide rates from 1999 to 2018. That said, there is a caveat. Young males and children did see a spike in suicides recently, including a 13% jump from boys aged 10 to 14. So overall, suicides are actually 10 down.
10 years old? Oh my God.
I know. Isn't that horrible?
Yes.
So overall, suicides are actually down. But if you're talking about children, and especially boy children, there has been an increase.
That is awful.
So then that gets us to what he said is maybe the most alarming, the study from Brown University about how children born after the pandemic performed poorly compared to pre-pandemic children of the same age on cognitive tests that measured like motor and other developmental skills. So I found this study. It's called The Impact of COVID-19 Pandemic on Early Child Cognitive Development. And there is also the study R Worth Paying Attention To. They examined general childhood cognitive scores in 2020 and 2021 and compared them to scores in the preceding decade from 2011 to 2019. They found that children born during the pandemic have significantly reduced verbal, motor, and overall cognitive performance compared to children born pre-pandemic. Males and children in lower socioeconomic families have been the most affected. Results highlight that even in the absence of direct COVID-19 infection, the environmental changes associated with the COVID-19 pandemic significantly and negatively affect infant and childhood development. So, like I said, that is alarming. What's important to keep in mind, though, is that this is a preprint and has not yet been peer-reviewed. That means that the research has yet to be evaluated and should not be used as a guide to clinical practice. And the authors of the study themselves are very clear on that point. I found a discussion of the paper where one of the study's authors, a guy named Sean Dione, said that the cognitive ability scores reported in the study are so low that he worries the results may not be right. Here's a direct quote from Dione. "The scores are really low, and that's a huge flag for us. Hence our desire to have this as preprint so that maybe other groups who have been able to keep assessing children in person throughout the past 18 months can reproduce the findings." So this is not a small point, and it's also not the first time that Tucker has referenced a preprint but failed to mention the lack of peer review. A responsible journalist would make note of that because it's important to the ability of the audience to interpret the information properly. In the case where one of the study's authors is saying, like, hey, these numbers are so low that it's a red flag for us, that's something you really should tell your audience if you're going to report on this, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
So then, now that Tucker has people feeling hopeless and dejected about the world within the first minute of his show.
Yeah, because we needed that.
Yeah, he's got a few more things to throw against the wall.
So that's a legitimate public health crisis. All of these are legitimate public health crises, but you never hear about them because the attention of our leaders is focused on COVID and particularly on the COVID vaccines. More vaccines, Joe Biden has told us repeatedly, are the answer, really the only answer. By and large, Americans have followed Biden's lead. They believe the president. As of tonight, about 82% of the entire adult population of the United States has received a COVID shot. In total, more than 232 million Americans have been vaccinated. That's the largest inoculation campaign in our history. You hear a lot about people who've resisted the shot, but most people haven't. In fact, more Americans have received the COVID vaccine than have a job or own a car or speak English as a first language. Effectively, pretty much everybody has had the shot. The country did what Joe Biden asked. We achieved universal vaccination.
Good.
Yeah, so that, unfortunately, that 82% figure he threw out is a little bit misleading. About 82% of Americans have received at least one dose of COVID vaccine.
Okay, so 82% are not vaccinated fully.
Yeah, that number does not represent the fully vaccinated portion of the population. If we're looking at people who are fully vaccinated, it's about 59.8%. The state with the highest vaccination rate is Vermont, with 73.5% of its population vaccinated. So not a single U.S. state has reached the 82% figure that Tucker is citing.
Good job, Vermont.
Yeah, go Vermont. Rep Birdie. Yeah. He said that more Americans have received the COVID vaccine than own a car. According to a Pew Research Center survey from 2015, 88% of Americans own a personal car or belong to a household that does. So even if we take Tucker's 82% vaccination figure, he's still wrong about that. That's including 24% of American households that own three or more cars, 3.4% that own more than five vehicles, 33.1% that own two cars, and 33.5% that own one car. He also said that more Americans have been vaccinated than have a job. As of November, the unemployment rate in the U.S. is 59.2%, a hair below the fully vaccinated rate of 59.8%. So I'll grudgingly give Tucker that one.
He said margins.
Yeah, very thin. And then he said more people have been vaccinated than speak English as a first language. As of 2018, 75% of Americans spoke only English, according to Census Bureau data. Only 21.9% of Americans primarily spoke a language other than English at home. According to 2020 census data, the estimate of the U.S. population that speak English less than very well is about 8.3%, which would mean that over 90% of U.S. residents from age 5 and older speak English very well. So it depends on exactly what vaccination number you're going with, but Tucker is more or less wrong about that.
Yeah.
And it might seem like I'm nitpicking here, but it's worth pointing out how sloppy Tucker is with information. He throws out this barrage of stats, only some of which are accurate and all of which lack context. This is because Tucker does not seek to actually inform his audience. Rather, he seeks to make them feel the right mix of anger, fear, resentment, and powerlessness that keeps their attention wrapped. We've made this point plenty of times over the course of this show, but it's worth harping on. If you're watching with an uncritical eye, it might feel like you've been informed. After all, he just listed off a whole slew of information. But the result is not a clear picture of reality. Instead, it's a generalized sense that things are bad. Furthermore, the reason that things are bad is because people in power made them that way on purpose to hurt you. And the only way that you can fight against them is to keep watching Tucker, because Tucker pisses them off. And so supporting him is its own little act of rebellion. It's a fundamentally abusive relationship between Tucker and his viewers. He casts his audience as powerful victims, himself as a hero, and then fights against the bad guys by telling you things that they don't want you to know. Context be damned.
So nothing really new. I was thinking, I was wondering how his scripts get to his desk. How much involvement does Tucker have in the writing process? Or do his researchers just be like, here's some articles, and then he reads the titles of them and then writes it himself or something? I don't know.
So that's something I spent a lot of time thinking about. I think that Tucker has a decent amount of creative control, at least over his monologues. I think he does at least part of the writing there. Because if you read like his books and stuff, the monologues are very much in his voice.
Okay.
And when I've heard him talk about his creative process, I know he starts his day with a sauna, and then he spends about 3 to 5 hours texting various people to get information. And then a guy named Tim Fox, who works for him, puts together a daily news digest. And from there, they kind of decide what they're going to talk about. I think I've heard him say he usually writes like the first draft of the monologues and then people will punch them up. The rest of the content on the show, I think he dictates a bit less. I think a lot of the guests that come on, it's related to like plug relationships, like, oh yeah, you can come on and promote this book or things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have been looking a bit more into some of the people who write for Tucker, like in particular, we're going to talk a little bit soon about Scooter Downey, who was the other writer credited on Patriot Purge and as you correctly pointed out, has a ridiculous name.
Yes. Didn't two Fox News writers quit last month or something?
Yes. Two contributors did. I know one was Jonah Goldberg. I don't remember offhand who the other was.
I remember I read an article about them. I don't remember their names either, but like it was like, hey, don't pretend that these guys aren't evil just because they think that they can't write for Fox anymore, because they like had a hand in like fear-mongering about foreign terrorists and 9/11 and stuff like that. I forget what all the examples were, but
yeah,
they'll suck even though they left.
Yeah, Jonah Goldberg, and I was one of these guys that he's wrong about most things, but occasionally has a take that I agree with. And so it makes sense that he's one of the ones scuttled under the weight of Tucker.
Yeah. And before it gets too far away from me, like, I know that Tucker is lying about like some of these statistics, but it's true that life sucks right now for a lot of people.
Yes.
And it really sucks that it didn't have to be that way. Like, if we had done a proper lockdown and like done a proper welfare protection so that people didn't starve if they had to quit working, like then we would probably still have some of these side effects, but we wouldn't also be dying of COVID. Like, I would rather people be poor than dead.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where Tucker will complain about these things, but then doesn't support any policy measures that would actually help any of the situations.
It's like all conservatives, they're like, oh, we're gonna fix your life, and then they just don't.
Oh, and before we carry on, something in there reminded me that there was some juicy Tucker news this week, and it's that
he like defended Chris, right?
Oh, we're gonna talk about that in a minute.
Oh, there's a different one.
Yeah, but so do you know who Lynn Wood is?
No, I know I've heard the name. So
he's a Trump world QAnon lawyer. He's called for civil war. He's a batshit lunatic.
One of those guys. Okay.
He also, early on after Kyle Rittenhouse shot three people in Kenosha, Lynn Wood was one of Kyle's defense attorneys, and he didn't end up staying on because Kyle was not happy with his counsel. In the interview that Tucker did with Kyle Rittenhouse, Kyle talked about how Lynn Wood, he feels, kept Kyle in jail longer than he needed to be in order to kind of fundraise off of the case. Like, look, this guy's sitting in jail. Give me money so I can defend him. And Kyle was like, he could have had me out of jail a lot sooner. He kept me in there to fundraise. Hmm. And so he talked about how...
astute observation, perhaps?
Yeah, and so as a result of that, the allegation in that interview, Lynn Wood released emails that Tucker Carlson sent to Hunter Biden years back.
I remember seeing this one now.
Yeah, so it seems to be the case that Tucker asked Hunter Biden to write his son Buckley a letter of recommendation for a college. And I've actually heard Tucker before. I'm going to try to track it down because I don't think it was on his show. But I've heard Tucker recently in some context talk about how he used to have dinner with Hunter Biden fairly regularly and always liked him. So it's another one of those things that, like, look how much of a performative hypocrite Tucker is when he attacks Hunter Biden all the time on his show and their buddies.
Exactly.
Hunter wrote his kid a recommendation letter. So let the lesson be, folks. Tucker is a disingenuous pile of shit. And that should be surprising to no one, but here we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like it when these assholes feud with each other. Like, because of this interview, Lynn Wood got mad and so then revealed these emails. Like, you guys can destroy each other all you want. I'm fine with that.
Yeah. I wish it mattered. Like, I wish, like, there was a the jig is up moment and then, like, someone would straighten out, but it never happens.
It never happens. So then, as a fun little segue, this clip is labeled More Death.
So what are the results of this? Let's see. More Americans have died from COVID in 2021 than died in 2020 before there was a shot. There were 362,000 deaths from COVID last year. So far this year, there have been 414,000 deaths. Overall, the United States has the highest number of COVID deaths of any country on the planet by far. So we gave up everything to fight COVID. We gave up our economy, our culture, our health. We literally stopped educating our own children. We did all of this in order to lower COVID deaths. And yet COVID deaths went up anyway, and they went up dramatically. So the obvious question is, how is this working? On the basis of the most simple numbers, it's not. In fact, it looks like the greatest public policy failure of all time.
So if we had actually had a lockdown that lasted more than like, we never had like a nationwide lockdown in the first place. So like the thing that you're complaining about is ridiculous. We very explicitly did not sacrifice the economy. We sacrificed our people to save the economy because the economy, well, for rich people, the stock market is doing fine, but people are dying. Isn't that something you should care about, Mr. I'm against the elites, Tucker Carlson?
You would think, huh? I haven't been able to find it, but someone I was talking to recently claimed that there is an old video in which Tucker talks about how essentially it's a good idea for the wealthy to play poor people against each other and keep them fighting amongst themselves so that they never unify against the elite. That seems like a fake quote to me, and I don't know if it's actually out there. But if anybody knows what this might have been referring to, I would love to see it. So let me know.
Yeah, that would be interesting to hear Tucker say, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I just to be clear, I've not been able to find that yet. But, you know, if it exists and you know about it, send me an email, please. I'd love to hear it.
Yes.
So, yeah, this thing about there being more deaths under Biden than under Trump. This has been a talking point among the right for the last week that I've heard quite a bit. Oh, look, Biden said he was going to get the virus under control, and now more people have died under Biden than died under Trump. Ignoring how linear time works to make a point.
Yeah.
For this, I'm going to quote from reporting by Aaron Blake of The Fix. The comparison between 2020 and 2021 is also inept in that Trump was still president in early 2021. And the effective choices made before Biden took over, such as Trump not really encouraging people to get vaccinated, lingered into Biden's early presidency. The biggest wave of the coronavirus in this country, in fact, peaked around the exact time Biden was inaugurated on January 20th. Inheriting a trend line that showed 3,000 deaths per day, as Biden did, is a recipe for inflating your numbers. To a significant degree, the wave was outside of Trump's control, of course. Most places in the world were experiencing the worst wave of the virus at that time. Even if we assumed all things were equal, though, the comparison still struggles. Both presidents presided over about 10 months of the pandemic. The World Health Organization declared that label on March 11th, meaning Trump was president for a little over 10 months of the formally declared pandemic. Biden has now passed a little more than 10 months in office as well. Thus far, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Biden has presided over about 353,000 deaths in a little over 10 months, compared to about 425,000 for Trump in his final 10 months in office. So there have still been fewer deaths under Biden than under Trump in a similar time period. The best comparison to my mind, though, is not the raw numbers, which depend on how bad things are, when waves occur, emerging variants, etc., but how we compare to the rest of the world. Just as the best comparisons for Trump's numbers worldwide were per capita and relative, so too are Biden's. Under Biden, we have accounted for a significantly smaller share of worldwide deaths than under Trump. The 425,000 deaths we saw in Trump's 10 months accounted for nearly 20% of all worldwide deaths, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Since Biden took over, the world as a whole has seen more deaths in his 10 months than the preceding 10 months, 3.7 million versus 2.14 million. But the United States has seen fewer. In Biden's 10 months, the United States has accounted for less than 12% of worldwide deaths, which is down from 19.9% under Trump. So that's a decline of more than 40% in our proportion of the worldwide death rate. Again, no comparisons are perfect, but if you look at how the virus has spread in similar countries between the two 10-month periods, the United States is generally doing better than it was, relatively speaking. Before January 20th, Europe accounted for more than 30% of coronavirus deaths. After that date, Europe has accounted for 25.2% of deaths. That's a smaller drop than we have seen in the United States, even as Europe's continent-wide vaccination rate is similar. Within Europe, you can cherry-pick your comparisons, but let's focus on a couple of countries. The United Kingdom, with its very high vaccination rates, has gone from 4.4% of worldwide deaths pre-January 20th to 1.7% afterward, a bigger relative drop than the United States. Germany has gone from 2.3% to 1.7%, a smaller drop than the United States. So the point here is that if you really want to look at the numbers, we fared better under Biden than under Trump. That's a reality kind of obscured by the raw death numbers, which I kind of expected given, again, linear time.
Yeah.
And this isn't like, we're never going to be bootlickers for Biden, but to thinking people, it should be pretty clear that a president who took a pandemic seriously would do a better job than one who didn't.
That's not a
hard logical leap to make.
Yeah, Trump didn't tell people to get the vaccine until after he was not president anymore. So
yeah, and then got booed for it.
Yep, then he got booed for it.
So then from here, Tucker talks about how the unvaccinated are the new kulaks, which is dumb. And then he says this.
Kulaks?
So they were essentially wealthy peasants in Soviet Russia who Stalin sought to eliminate as a class because they owned more land than other categories of peasants and had a greater share of wealth.
Okay. Okay.
How does Joe Biden explain that? What does Tony Fauci say about it or Rochelle Walensky? Well, nothing. Not a word. No one in charge has even acknowledged the magnitude of the failure. They haven't had to acknowledge it because they've created a scapegoat to take the blame for it. The scapegoat is called the unvaccinated, a phrase that everyone understands is essentially political. It means working class whites who probably voted for Trump. This is all their fault. Everything bad they did. Over the weekend, various White House officials blamed this group not simply for COVID, but for virtually everything that has gone wrong since Joe Biden has become president. And there's a lot. The collapse of the U.S. dollar, supply chain implosions, empty shelves in stores, labor shortages, even rising gas prices.
So I thought it was interesting there that he said everyone understands the unvaccinated to mean working class whites who voted for Trump. What he's doing there is rhetorically seeding the idea that when politicians talk about the unvaccinated, they're talking about you, white people, which, coming off of our episode about Mike Enoch, seems especially relevant.
Yeah. Oh, man, that was so bad. That was so, so bad.
The white victimhood narratives are consistent. The messaging that you're being targeted because you're white and you're working class, that is a shared mode of communication between the two men. And yep. That's worth highlighting because I think it's dangerous.
I think you are correct about that.
And then you can't talk about COVID, Tyler, without talking about the man, the myth, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Someday when the fog lifts and art returns, somebody's going to write a hilarious novel about this moment. And of course, one of the stars of it will be a nearly 81-year-old bureaucrat who really shouldn't be driving a car at this point, but who somehow took control of the most powerful country on earth and then promptly went insane. If you haven't checked in on Tony Fauci lately, you may be a little surprised to discover what he's become. If you tuned in a couple of years ago, you may recall Fauci as a conventional public health official. He wore button-down shirts. He gave careful, precise answers that suggested deep medical knowledge. No more. After 2 years of nonstop media adulation, Tony Fauci has morphed into an even shorter version of Benito Mussolini. Watch Fauci on television the other day refer to himself without even flinching in the third person.
Well, there are a lot of Republican senators taking aim at this.
That's okay. I'm just going to do my job. And I'm going to be saving lives, and they're going to be lying. There's a distinct anti-science flavor to this. So if they get up and criticize science, nobody's going to know what they're talking about. But if they get up and really aim their bullets at Tony Fauci, well, people could recognize there's a person there. So it's easy to criticize, but they're really criticizing science because I represent science.
When they criticize me, they're criticizing science. I am science, declares Tony Fauci. Science is me. So clearly, something deep inside Tony Fauci has changed. The man now believes he's a deity accountable to no one.
Okay. A couple of things in there that I wouldn't mind talking about. Way to say that he said things he didn't say, Tucker.
Yeah, the old Tucker classic.
Yeah, yeah. And then just some of the, he just says some of the weirdest ass shit. Like, when Art returns? What do you mean?
Yeah, Art has been on a long sabbatical, kind of its own hero's journey.
yeah, because no music has been released in the last 2 years, and no movies have come out, and no nothing. No podcasts have been created as a result of the pandemic. No YouTube channels have taken off. No Twitch streams have taken off. Nothing. There's no art. It's all been on hold.
Also, I question whether or not he knows what a novel is when he said someone's going to write a great novel about this. So one of the key characters will be Anthony Fauci. Novels usually involve fictional characters.
Yeah, it'll be a romance about how foxy Anthony Fauci is.
I mean, Tucker's dad did write a novel about Hillary Clinton getting kidnapped. So he's coming off with a hindered interpretation to begin with, I guess.
Hold on. Actually Hillary Clinton, or like an obvious Hillary Clinton caricature?
No, just literally Hillary Clinton.
And then there was a publisher that was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's called Snatching Hillary. I read the first chapter. It seems like the main joke seems to be that Hillary Clinton said fuck and is mean to her Secret Service detail.
Petty.
I like to think I'll read more of it someday, but who can say?
Last thing Tucker said that caught my ear was Anthony Fauci's, I forget his exact wording, but his answers to questions suggest medical knowledge, not his doctorate from Cornell. What do you mean? We don't respect people based on how much we like their answers randomly off the street.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense, though, if that's how Tucker gauges scientific knowledge. It's like,
yeah, for sure.
But yeah, the obviously Tucker, Tony Fauci did not say "I am science," as Tucker proclaimed.
No,
he did not. He said that "I represent science," and he said that in the context of Republican senators capitalizing on this on a anti-science mentality in the culture, to attack Tony Fauci as a stand-in for COVID measures based on scientific recommendations. Any thinking person would not hear that as Tony Fauci saying, "I am science."
Right. Yeah.
You know, this is Tucker we're dealing with. So then finally we get to there's a new variant, Tyler.
Yes, and it has the silliest name ever.
It does.
Like a Transformers antagonist.
Damn it, you beat me to it by half a second. I was gonna say, I don't know why they named it after the villain in the 1980s Transformers movie.
Is that actually the villain's name?
Unicron.
Okay. I thought it was something similar, but yeah.
Also appeared in a bastardized form in Transformers 4, The Last Knight, I believe, but we don't talk about that.
The Last Knight is Transformers 5, get it straight.
Oh, you're totally right. I fucked up. Yeah, because 4 was where they introduced new guy, fucking Mark Wahlberg or whatever.
Yeah, Cade or something.
Yeah, and then there was that moment where the daughter's boyfriend, because I think
was
like,
17, yeah.
Yeah, like she was 17 and the boyfriend was 18 and he had a copy of Texas's Romeo and Juliet laws on a card he carried in his wallet.
Yeah, he was like, no, my girlfriend's dad, it's fine if I fuck your 17-year-old daughter and I'm an adult man because I have a card.
Look here, I laminated the card. This is legal for me to fuck your daughters.
Because that was the problem, right? That was the legality of the situation.
maybe like can we do a Transformers podcast instead? Can we just scrap the rest of this episode?
okay. Yes. Do you remember when we sat and read Transformers erotic fan fiction?
Yes.
At your house one day. That could be a podcast.
Yeah, y'all, there exists a Transformers Harry Potter crossover fanfic in which Megatron and Starscream,
and it's amazing.
Megatron and Starscream fuck on top of Hogwarts and kill several of the young wizards in the process. There's also one I read where Harry.
So good. It's so good.
Like, there's actually a robust a canon of Transformers Harry Potter crossover fic. I read one where Harry and Hermione came out to each other as trans, meaning Transformers, and they both transformed in front of one another.
Yeah. Oh man.
Okay, so the fucking Omicron variant.
Oh yeah, we have to talk about COVID.
This new variant was discovered by the chair of the South African Medical Association, a woman called Angelique Coetzee. Here's how she describes the threat.
Looking at the mildness of the symptoms that we are seeing, currently there's no reason for panicking as we don't see severely ill patients.
There's no reason to panic. It's very mild, she tells us. Very mild. We don't see very ill patients. Now, normally that would be good news for everyone, but in this country, it is cause for even deeper and more profound alarm. In the state of New York, the unelected governor has just banned all elective surgeries at hospitals because of this new variant. Now, keep in mind, there are precisely zero confirmed cases of this variant in the state of New York. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't be afraid. Oh, you should definitely be afraid. Thanks to this mild yet terrifying new variant, Joe Biden told us today, you must get your third vaccine.
You have to get your vaccine. You have to get the shot. You have to get the booster. If you're sooner or later, we're going to see cases of this new variant here in the United States. We'll have to face this new threat just as we face those that come before it.
Message? Don't listen to the doctors. It's mild. It's not a problem. But that doesn't mean you can even think about relaxing. There is plenty of fear ahead. And you're going to need to listen very, very carefully to Anthony Fauci.
Who was that lady? What?
So that was a... Let me pull her up so I don't get the nationality wrong. Okay, yeah. So that was a South African doctor named Dr. Coetzee. She was essentially describing what she's been seeing with the patients infected with the Omicron variant. And the patients that she's been treating, they have milder symptoms than other infected people.
Okay.
And at this point, like, there's a lot that just isn't known about the Omicron variant yet. It may well be...
Yeah, I mean, it got here a week ago.
Yeah, like, it may well be the case that symptoms are milder, which would be great. So far, all of the evidence from that is based off of younger people who have been infected who tend to have less severe cases anyway.
Okay. It's a factor.
There's just not there's not good, robust evidence yet to point one way or the other. There seem to be some indications that it might be milder, but better at circumventing vaccines. But again, it's just not known with any real certainty yet. And so what we have there is, in the face of a variant that we don't know much about yet, the president urging caution and Tucker saying, look at this idiot telling you to be cautious.
Yeah, but also fear-mongering at the same time somehow? I don't know.
I mean, this one doctor said that it's mild, so clearly there's nothing to worry about. So why are they saying that we still need to do all these safety precautions? Just get sick, losers. That's essentially his messaging.
Because milder symptoms is the same thing as not dangerous at all.
Yeah. So, yeah, I assume we'll talk more about Omicron when there's more, like, science that I can point to. At this point, there's a lot of just, like, seems to be and could be, and I don't feel comfortable wading too deep into that. So then we're going to step away from COVID for a minute, though we'll circle back a little bit later, because Tucker has another story, and I've been waiting for him to bring this to bear.
Well, a black nationalist with an extensive documented history of race hate just ran over dozens of people in the state of Wisconsin. He killed six, including an 8-year-old boy. But the media are on to the real culprit, the actual killer, which was the car. Candace Owens joins us straight ahead.
And don't worry, we're not going to listen to Candace today.
You have done me a solid. I owe you one.
She brings nothing. She brings nothing to this conversation that Tucker doesn't say himself, so I decided that we didn't need to deal with her this time around.
You're so kind to me, Troy.
But yeah, this in Waukesha, Wisconsin, we mentioned it last week. This guy, Daryl Brooks, drove an SUV through a Christmas parade and killed six people, injured like 40. Obviously, it's a horrible story. And I in no way want any of what I'm about to say to sound like I'm defending the actions of Daryl Brooks. However, I do think that it's very irresponsible for Tucker to be painting this as an anti-white racial attack when there's no evidence to support that at this point.
Yeah, I haven't heard the black nationalist thing until now. Did he identify himself that way?
No.
I didn't think so.
So what Tucker is referring to when he says that Daryl Brooks had a well-documented history of race hate is the content of a Facebook page belonging to Brooks that has since been deleted. Here are a couple of the posts in question on that Facebook page. On June 9th of 2020, he shared an ESPN article about NBA player Kyle Kuzma explaining his belief of what white privilege is. Kuzma described white privilege as a backpack that some people are born with, that when they end up in a bad situation, they have the option to open up the backpack and pull out all sorts of useful shit. He used that as kind of a metaphor for explaining his conception of white privilege. But Daryl Brooks shared that article and commented, "Interesting." That same month, he shared a post about a white police officer being violent toward peaceful protesters. Another post showed support for Black Lives Matter, accompanied by the middle finger emoji and a police officer emoji. A more recent post on the Facebook's account showed Daryl Brooks weighing in on the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict, saying he wasn't surprised one bit. And the post that gets most commonly mentioned as a cult of violence is learned and taught behavior. So when we start back knocking white people the fuck out, I don't want to hear it. The old white people too, knock them the fuck out, period. That was the post that everybody says was inciting violence against white people. So none of these posts are anything outrageous or beyond the pale. Like, it's all pretty typical stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing here that, certainly nothing that points to some motive for an anti-white racial terror attack.
Yeah, no, usually people who commit terror attacks are like really obvious when you look at their like Twitter accounts or whatever. And like, I'm not getting that from this guy.
There's another thing that's instructive here, and that there was a post on the Facebook page that I do think is a bit problematic. And it's one that Tucker or nobody in his circle want to talk about. Daryl Brooks shared a meme titled "Hitler Knew Who the Real Jews Were." The message claimed Adolf Hitler had warned that his genocide was partly prompted because he knew that, quote, the Negroes are the true Hebrews, appearing to promote the view of Black Hebrew Israelites who believe that they're, essentially, this is a belief that Black people are the real Jews and what we consider the Jews are imposters. The post added that America had moved, quote, false white Jews into a state of Israel, and that World War III would unfold when people learned Hitler was right and did the world a favor by killing Jews. So,
okay.
So that post is absolutely... Brooks commented on the meme, "Real game right here," which was accompanied by the hashtag research. So that post is a bit problematic and points towards some things that I would say are worth taking a look at.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that Tucker doesn't bring this up at all, that post. Nor is it mentioned at all in the numerous posts about this on the Tucker Carlson subreddit, because that post isn't useful to them, because a lot of their fans also think Hitler was right to kill the Jews.
Right. As we discussed last week.
I think Tucker's framing of the story is irresponsible, and it's really frustrating the game he plays that he I didn't say that this was an anti-white terror attack. I just said that it was a terror attack, and the guy who committed it was an anti-white hater.
Blah, blah, blah. If you put the two pieces of the puzzle together that I laid out for you, you're the idiot.
Yeah, it's clearly by saying those two things in sequence, I did not intend for you to draw a connection between them, idiot. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, as are many things on this show.
Yeah, so then let's hear Tucker talk a little bit more about Daryl Brooks.
Daryl Brooks is a BLM supporter and a black nationalist with the history of expressing anti-white race hate on social media. On November 21st, Brooks ran over dozens of people who were attending a Christmas parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Six of those victims have died so far, including an 8-year-old boy. This is what the attack looked like.
He then plays a video of the attack. This is an audio medium, so it doesn't really do us any good here, so I cut it out. But yeah, so again, not trying to make any excuses for what Daryl Brooks did in this case. But I think the details Tucker is leaving out here are important. Daryl Brooks has a pretty long criminal history. In fact, he was out on bail for a different hit and run incident at the time that this occurred. Along with that, he has a pretty extensive history of mental illness, and his family has released a statement about how they feel Daryl Brooks was failed by the system and that he never had opportunity for any help for his mental state that he could afford. So I found the criminal complaint against Daryl Brooks in relation to the Waukesha parade attack. And in reading the description of the event by the police involved here, it paints a very different picture than the one Tucker is describing. From the complaint, at approximately 4:35 p.m., Detective Casey heard via the Waukesha police radio that a reserve officer was informed by a citizen that two people were fighting in the area of White Rock School. Squads were sent to that area to further investigate. A few minutes later, Detective Casey heard a horn honking from an area north of his location. Detective Casey went out onto White Rock Avenue to see where the horn sound was coming from. He observed that White Rock Avenue was filled with parade participants, as was East Main Street. He began to see people spreading apart and observed a red Ford Escape driving southbound on White Rock Avenue. He observed people jumping out of the way of the red Ford Escape. Detective Casey stepped in front of the vehicle and pounded on the hood and yelled multiple times, "Stop." Detective Casey was wearing a shirt with patches on both shoulders that stated Waukesha Police, as well as wearing a black hat with white letters on the front and a hat which stated police. Further, he was wearing a neon orange safety vest that stated police in the front and the back of it. The Ford Escape continued driving and turned westbound on East Main Street. At that time, the vehicle was driving at a slow speed, and the vehicle brushed Detective Casey back off the front of the car, causing him to be positioned down the driver's side of the vehicle. Detective Casey went to the driver's side window and pounded on the driver's side door, yelling, "Stop." Detective Casey subsequently identified the driver of the Ford Escape as Daryl E. Brooks, here and now to refer to as the defendant. The defendant drove past Detective Casey and into the parade procession. Detective Casey chased the vehicle to East Avenue on foot, and he observed the vehicle begin to drive faster. Detective Casey broadcast over the radio that the red Ford Escape had entered the parade route and he needed squads to respond in an emergency fashion. A few seconds later, Detective Casey heard on the police radio that the vehicle was striking people and was continuing westbound on East Main Street. Officer Butrin was assisting with crowd control in the area of East Main Street and Northeast Avenue. At approximately 4:38 p.m., Officer Butrin heard on his radio that a car was traveling westbound, approaching the parade route. Officer Butrin observed a red Ford Escape traveling westbound on White Rock Avenue, approaching East Main Street. He began walking onto East Main Street into the parade in an attempt to get the driver's attention, stop the vehicle, and redirect the vehicle from the parade route. The vehicle turned right onto East Main Street toward Officer Butrin. As the vehicle was traveling westbound on East Main Street, Officer Butrin was standing directly in line with the vehicle, wearing a full City of Waukesha Police Department uniform. He put his hand up and yelled, "Stop, stop the vehicle," multiple times. Based upon his training and experience, Officer Butrin estimated the vehicle's speed to be about 25 miles an hour. The vehicle was initially sticking to the north side of the road in an open lane between the parade participants and spectators. Officer Butrin observed the driver looking straight ahead directly at him and appeared to have no emotion on his face. As the vehicle passed his location, Officer Butrin continually yelled for the vehicle to stop. The vehicle continued traveling westbound on East Main Street and passed through the intersection of East Main Street and Buckley Street. Officer Butrin concluded that if the driver was lost and attempting to get out of the parade, this would have been a reasonable occasion for him to stop and exit the parade route. The vehicle continued westbound and was honking its horn. As the vehicle got to Martin Street, it appeared to Officer Butrin that the vehicle began to increase its speed. As the vehicle was traveling westbound, the vehicle began getting closer to parade spectators and almost struck a small juvenile who was standing in one of the parking stalls on the north side of the road as the speed was increasing. The vehicle then got to the intersection of East Main Street and North Barstow Street, and it appeared the brakes were activated. Officer Butrin believed the vehicle was going to come to a stop and attempt to make a right-hand turn out of the parade route. However, the vehicle then appeared to rapidly accelerate. As Officer Butrin heard tires squeal, the vehicle took an abrupt left turn into the crowd of parade participants. At this point, it was clear to Officer Butrin that this was an intentional act to strike and hurt as many people as possible. So it goes on and describes the event from there. What I found interesting was that they get to a third detective on the case. Detective Trissoni spoke with multiple citizen witnesses who were present during the parade. One witness indicated, quote, "As I continued to watch the SUV, it continued to drive in a zigzag motion. It was like the SUV was trying to avoid vehicles, not people. There was no attempt by the vehicle to stop, much less slow down. So, and again, this is kind of conjecture based off of this complaint. But the vibe I'm kind of getting from the sequence of events here, it seems like Daryl Brooks, who at the time was out on bail and had an active warrant for his arrest in another state, in addition to a long history of bad interactions with the police and probable drug abuse and mental illness. He's driving, he gets caught up in this parade procession. And at this point, he's driving slowly, right? Slow enough that the cop is able to walk up and walk around the vehicle.
Yeah.
At the point that police start trying to get Daryl Brooks to stop, seems to be when he panicked and increased speed. What it kind of seems like happened here is that he freaked out when the police got involved, didn't want to be arrested, tried to speed away. And there's disagreement over whether or not the zigzagging was to try and hit people or to avoid cars. It would make sense to me that, you know, if you're trying to flee a scene, you want to not hit other cars. So this isn't to try and diminish the case at all. I don't think that this was as Tucker is implying, a racially motivated terror attack. I think it's more likely that this was a drug-addled, a mentally ill guy running from police and winding up.
Yes, I think you are probably correct about that.
So then Tucker, before he brings on Candace, he has another final thought on this, and I think it's just disgusting.
So how did this happen? Well, of course, we don't know yet. There's been no trial. There aren't enough available facts. But we do know that this comes within the context of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, which had nothing whatsoever to do with race. But for more than a year, our national media framed it as some sort of referendum on American race relations and white supremacy. They made it all about race. It's possible that Daryl Brooks bought into that propaganda. It seems to be all over his Facebook account. So the media may be responsible for these murders, having convinced this man and certainly a lot of other people in the country that the Kyle Rittenhouse case was about race. They had a role in this, in other words. So it probably shouldn't surprise you that the national media have zero interest in explaining what exactly happened in Waukesha. Over on MSNBC, for example, they've been telling you the attack was really just an accident.
One thing I do worry, actually two things, Stephanie, is one is the idea of contagion. Whether it has anything to do with this accident last night and the killing of these people, others might be thinking of an attack like this somewhere in the world.
Oh, it was an accident. Meanwhile, at CNN, they've identified a culprit. It wasn't Daryl Brooks. It wasn't the national media whipping the country into a frenzy of suspicion and racism. No. It was the car. Quote, a car drove through a city Christmas parade, killing six people and injuring scores of others. End quote. The Washington Post agreed with this. Quote, here's what we know so far in the sequence of events that led to the Waukesha tragedy caused by an SUV. End quote. So which SUVs are the most dangerous? Why are they still being sold? How many of them might just drive off the lot and wind up in the middle of a parade? The Washington Post didn't explain.
So that, his obvious harping on the SUV headline thing aside, what he is implying there is that the media are culpable for this attack because they hyped up the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and pretended it was a racial issue and whipped the country up into this racial frenzy. And so, therefore, the media are to blame when a black nationalist like Daryl Brooks takes this propaganda to heart and acts on it. He's essentially inverting the sequence of events that lead to shows like his leading to white nationalist terror attacks. But in this case, he's just lying about all the necessary components, and it's really fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, just imagine for a moment if a white guy had drove through a crowd, and then, say, the Washington Post put out an article about how that driver had anti-BLM Facebook posts. And so then they called him a white nationalist and said, this is white nationalist terror. Tucker would be furious about that. Just because he doesn't like Black Lives Matter on his Facebook page, you're allowed to post about that. We know how that coverage would sound.
Yeah.
And then other big news, the Ghislaine Maxwell trial has started.
Oh, yeah. I have not paid attention to that at all.
Nor have I. But it, you know how the height of humor for Tucker Carlson is mispronouncing words?
Yeah.
So the Ghislaine Maxwell trial has begun. You may not have known that because it's not getting a ton of coverage. It's not getting the attention, say, the Kyle Rittenhouse trial got. Why is that exactly? And what is going on in this trial? And who's being implicated? And will you ever hear about it? That's straight ahead.
So there's a very simple reason why there's been less media coverage of this trial so far. And that's because, unlike with the Rittenhouse trial, cameras are not allowed in federal courtrooms. So there's not dramatic footage of the proceedings.
Okay. Maybe that should be true for all courtrooms.
Yeah. Yeah. If only.
Actually.
I think that he feels like he fudged mispronouncing her name a little bit there. He got too close to the actual name, so he's going to take another swing at it.
You're kidding.
Trial of Ghislaine, or we're just too darn American to pronounce it. But anyway, the Maxwell trial's just begun. You'd think it would be the trial of the century, but it's not. The media seem to be mostly ignoring it. That's weird. Maxwell is accused of providing underage girls to Jeffrey Epstein as part of an international sex trafficking ring that likely involves world leaders. Well, that's pretty interesting. For example, we know that Bill Clinton flew on Epstein's plane a total of 26 times.
Yeah, so he talks a lot about Bill Clinton's connections to Jeffrey Epstein here. Weird that he doesn't talk about the other U.S. president with clear Epstein connections.
Yeah, interesting.
Just kind of conspicuous in his absence there. The guy photographed with Epstein all the time.
All the time.
And that's all that we're really going to talk about that coverage at this point. I imagine that we'll probably have more to say, like, when there's actual information from the trial. But at this point, it's just Tucker bitching about, like, why aren't people covering this? And there's nothing. There's no meat on that bone.
Yeah.
Then Tucker wants to talk about Bitcoin.
Oh, boy.
You see, Tyler, he explains that for more than a year, his team has scoured the country far and wide, looking for someone who could adequately explain what Bitcoin is to his audience. And the guy they settled on was this dude named Michael Saylor. He's a billionaire investor. Saylor doesn't seem to suck more than your typical billionaire sucks, but he definitely sucks. He was at one point charged with some securities fraud. He wound up, like, settling in that case without admission of guilt. And the settlement resulted in a loss of $6 billion to his net worth.
Holy shit.
What's interesting to me is that I'm sure Michael Saylor at that point, given that he had billions of dollars, also had really good lawyers. And if you're going to settle like that, that's usually the better option than letting the case go to trial. So if losing $6 billion was the better option, then there must have been some pretty heavy shit.
Yeah.
Leveraged against him.
Like, how did you get away with so much?
But yeah, Tucker had Michael Saylor on Tucker Carlson Today to talk about Bitcoin. And there's a new record because Michael Saylor in this interview talks uninterrupted for 47 minutes straight.
What?
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Why? Why is that?
But they play a sampling from that here. And we're not going to deal with this much, but I do want to play this clip. Because Tucker bills this as the guy they searched far and wide to find somebody who can really explain Bitcoin. So this is his explanation after all this time.
The currency is to the economy what your blood is to your body, and economic energy or money is to the currency what oxygen is to your blood. So common sense says, if I keep sucking the oxygen out of the room, if I suck the oxygen out of the room, you're going to either suffocate or freeze to death. And if I keep sucking the economic energy out of the currency, the economy collapses. In the extreme, you get ripped back to Stone Age barter, right? When the money doesn't work anymore, right. I have to trade you cigarettes for bullets.
Right.
And the problem with that is the economy becomes a million times less efficient, right? If you don't have money, now, how many countries in the world have a collapsed currency? 66 are dollarized, There's 180 about countries, there's 130 floating currencies. All of them are weaker than the dollar. The U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency. The U.S. dollar is expanding. It was expanding 10% a year for a decade, now expanding at 14% a year. It expanded 34% over the past 12 months. The dollar is weakening. Okay? It's like the oxygen is getting sucked out of the room. So, Tucker, if I told you the oxygen is getting sucked out of the room and there's an oxygen mask drops out of the ceiling over there, what would you do?
Run for it.
Yeah. Put the oxygen mask on. Bitcoin is the oxygen mask.
So do you understand Bitcoin better now?
No, not exactly.
Also, something I think is interesting is that Tucker mentions that the morning of that interview with Michael Saylor, Saylor's firm dumped a bunch of money into Bitcoin. It seems interesting to me that a guy who has committed securities fraud before, the morning he goes on a popular talk show to talk about Bitcoin to an audience of mostly older people who probably don't have a good understanding of what Bitcoin is.
He doesn't mention Bitcoin a single time.
Yeah, well, and then prior to that, he buys a bunch of Bitcoin. I imagine that, this is conjecture on my part, but I imagine that there's a good chance some of Tucker's 3 million viewers might think, man, I should buy me some of that Bitcoin. And then value goes up, yep. And Michael Saylor makes a profit. Weird.
Yeah. Interesting.
So that's all we're going to talk about Bitcoin for today, because I can't talk anymore about Bitcoin without wanting to set myself on fire.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a scam.
And now, Tyler, we're on to maybe greener pastures, because this is how Tucker closes Monday.
So our friend Matt Walsh is not a children's book author, strictly speaking, but he has a new children's book out. It's called Johnny the Walrus. He'll explain what it's about and why you're going to want to buy 6 copies for Christmas. Trust us, it's worth it. We'll be right back.
I'm going to talk about Johnny the Walrus.
Oh, God, I don't want to listen to Matt Walsh.
Hey, I spared you Candace today, but we have to suffer through Matt Walsh.
That is a trade that I can accept. Every time conservatives make children's books, they're extremely awful.
Yeah, it's going to be no exception, I promise. Here, before we get into it, what do you think Johnny the Walrus is about?
Oh, man. The hot button issue for conservatives is like trans rights. So I feel like Johnny the Walrus is going to be like, I don't really feel like being a walrus anymore. I'm going to identify as a penguin. And then the community is going to be like, no, you can't do that because you're obviously a walrus. It's in your DNA. And then that will be the end of the story, is to hate trans people.
You are shockingly close.
Matt Walsh is an enormously smart person, one of our favorite guests. He's host of the Matt Walsh Show. Honestly, you think of him as a political guy, and yet Matt Walsh is out with a new children's book. The book is called Johnny the Walrus. What is this about? A shameless money-making scheme? Or maybe there's more to it? Matt Walsh joins us tonight to explain. Matt, congrats on branching out. What is this book?
This is Johnny the Walrus. I have embraced my true calling as a children's author, hence the cardigan. And this is a very real book. It's on sale at johnnythewalrus.com right now. It's all about a child who's, you know, very imaginative. He likes to pretend to be different things. And one day he pretends to be a walrus, and he's got spoons in his mouth like tusks and socks on his hands like fins. And unfortunately, his mother is very progressive and thus confused. And so she's convinced by the internet and by society that if your child is identifying as something, then he really is that thing. And so she tries to raise her child as a walrus, as a sort of trans walrus, respecting his self-identity. At one point, I don't want to give away the ending, it gets a little dark. At one point, she brings him to a doctor and they talk about transitioning, a medical transition into a walrus, a gruesome procedure. But throughout the story, you know, she does eventually start to learn that just because your child is pretending to be something doesn't mean that he actually is that thing.
Okay, so if you believe you're a walrus, that doesn't mean you actually are a walrus. That's kind of the point.
Yeah, if you believe you're a walrus, doesn't mean you're actually walrus. And, you know, you might also draw other comparisons. Maybe, like, if a young boy says that he's a girl, doesn't mean that he actually is a girl. See, the point here is that biology is not malleable. It's not relative. Oh. It's an objective reality. And so that's what we have to understand. And the children, when they make many claims about themselves. They're imaginative people. But when we take that seriously, we end up foisting an identity crisis on them, like Johnny does to like Johnny's mother does to him, unfortunately. And it can lead to terrible things.
Amazing. I've actually read the book. I'm going to be honest with our audience. And it's hilarious. Not only is it true, it is really, really funny. Not surprisingly, since you wrote it. Matt Walsh, I hope that is a runaway bestseller this Christmas, because it is definitely deserves to be. Great to see you tonight. Congrats.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Glad to see Matt has not quit his diet of cigarettes.
Did you catch the moment in there where Matt Walsh was explaining the meaning of the book and Tucker goes, oh.
Yeah. I didn't really think about it until you said that, but
I legit did a fucking spit take, Tyler. That was so funny to me.
Oh, kids can't be walruses. What? Okay. Okay. I feel like we've this is well trodden ground at this point, but kids pretending to be something is not the same as demonstrating the behavior of like transgender identity.
Yeah, I pretended to be Spider-Man all the goddamn time as a kid. I never like believed that I was Spider-Man. It's not the same fucking thing. Like, and you know how I know it's not the same thing? Because there are not people who go their entire lives from a young age knowing in their hearts that they are Spider-Man.
Right.
Did I ever make you watch Tusk?
I think you skipped through it and showed me the good parts. And then I erased it from my memory because it was terrifying.
There is a movie called Tusk in which the main character is surgically transformed into a walrus. And then does battle with the scientist in a walrus helm. It's one of the best things I've ever seen. I thoroughly recommend it to anybody who has an evening to kill and drugs to ingest.
So did conservatives forget that the only joke that they tell about trans people was a joke? Did he just forget that's a joke? Like, no. I identify as a walrus. Like, that, did they forget that was a joke? Because it's always been a joke, and it's always been a bad joke.
Well, you see, Tyler, Matt Walsh here. The first draft of my book was actually Johnny the Attack Helicopter. But then I was worried about getting sued by 4chan. So I looked around. I was like, what else could a kid try to be?
Is a walrus a common thing to pretend to be as a child? I don't know if I ever did the walrus thing.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever did. I definitely remember being a snot walrus when I was sick.
A snot walrus. Okay. All right. That's a new one for me. I'm not saying you can't. I feel like there's more popular animals that a kid might pretend to be.
And the point being made here, like, what is frustrating to me is that the butt of the joke in the book is not the kid pretending to be a walrus, but the kid's mother who believes he actually is a walrus. And that I do take issue with that kind of messaging. It's not as egregious as when Tucker had Billy Burley on a couple of months back, because Billy Burley was the guy who had transitioned and had a horrible experience with it, had a bunch of medical complications, and then detransitioned a few years later.
Okay. Thank you for the refresher.
Yeah. And Tucker was like, well, what do you say to parents whose kids think they might be trans? And that I think was worse than this, but the message is the same, that like parents who take their kids' expressions of their identity seriously are worthy of ridicule. And
yeah,
I do have to think, like, I don't know. I've got to think about how, like, if my dad had had people in his life who understood what he was experiencing and told him that his experience of the world was okay and that he wasn't wrong for it, I have to think that things might have turned out differently for him. And and that's really just like the, even when they're doing dumb shit like this, these people are doing harm to the world. Like, this is harmful to people. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's the end of Monday's show. And on Tuesday, Tucker dedicates his intro to reminding us that no matter what it is, he will always have the worst take.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Big changes in the tiny hothouse, and it is tiny, of cable news this evening. CNN's top-rated anchor, Chris Cuomo, has been pulled off the air, likely for good. We'll probably never see him on camera again. For us here at Fox, it feels like the end of something. Like most Americans, we never actually watched the Chris Cuomo show, assuming that was its name. But over the years, we saw his clips, and they transfixed us. Very often as a public service, but also because honestly we could not help ourselves, we brought them to you. How, we wondered, did a man who could barely speak English wind up with a paying job on television? Was it some kind of weird affirmative action program for the illiterate? We never figured it out, but it was remarkable to see it. Sentence after badly mangled sentence, a bouillabaisse of incomprehensible grammar. You couldn't understand any of it. It was a kind of performance art. A communicator wholly unable to communicate. And then there was the weightlifting. There was nothing wrong with lifting weights or keeping in shape, obviously. But there was always something very wrong with the videos that Chris Cuomo had shot of himself and then put on the internet. Imagine wanting other people to see this.
That he plays a montage of Chris Cuomo's workout videos.
After criticizing him for showing them?
Yeah, which, I mean, they are kind of cringy, but it's whatever. It's obviously, like, a meme-y thing. I'm sure Cuomo fans loved it.
Yeah. This is pretty beta energy, Tucker, caring that other people have muscles and you don't.
Yeah, so but what he's building to here is obviously that Chris Cuomo, for anybody who hasn't heard, has been fired from CNN.
Yes, he has.
And here, Tucker has the worst interpretation of events that he could have had, I think.
At CNN, there is no penalty for falseness. The only thing you can't do at CNN, the thing that they will never tolerate, is displeasing the people in charge. That means not simply Jeff Zucker, who runs the company, but the billionaires who run our country. If you cross them, you're done. So this morning, when we saw the Atlantic magazine, we knew it was curtains for Chris Cuomo. The Atlantic is owned by Steve Jobs' widow. It functions as a kind of modern social register, a place for the ruling class to talk to itself. And the Atlantic decided that it was deeply displeased Chris Cuomo had dared to help his brother, the former governor of New York, when he was accused of sexual harassment. Chris Cuomo must go, the Atlantic declared. And then we knew he would. We knew it was over. In the world that Jeff Zucker lives in, the Atlantic makes the rules. Cuomo was done. And that's when, for the first time ever, and very unexpectedly, we started to feel sorry for Chris Cuomo. Helping his brother is not the worst thing Chris Cuomo ever did. In fact, it may have been the best thing he ever did. Not because Andrew Cuomo was a good person. He certainly wasn't a good person. Andrew Cuomo was loathsome. But Andrew Cuomo was Chris Cuomo's brother. And that's what you do with brothers, even the loathsome ones. You help them when they need it. Period. It's called loyalty. At CNN, as at the rest of the media, this is an alien concept. Is there a single person at CNN or any other left-wing network who would risk his job to help his own brother? No. Above all, these people are careerists, ruthless careerists. They would betray anyone to get ahead. If Jeff Zucker told this guy to denounce his own wife on television, do you think he'd hesitate before doing it?
He just put up a picture of Brian Stelter, so that's the guy he's talking about.
Of course he wouldn't, not for a second. So when we tell you that the media are corrupt, we don't just mean they're corrupt politically. It is much deeper than that. They don't acknowledge the most important rules in life. Your first obligation is to your family. Your first obligation is not to the state. It's not to a political party. It's not to Jeff Zucker or some creepy billionaire at the Atlantic magazine. It's not even to your own career. Your most basic obligation is to the people you are related to. When they need your help, no matter who they are, even if they're the governor of a state, even if they're horrible people, you help them anyway, because it's your family. Chris Cuomo may be an idiot, and he is, but he understands that. What a thing to be fired for.
So, Chris Cuomo was fired because in the wake of his brother's sexual assault allegations. Chris Cuomo used his position at CNN to query other journalists about the status of the charges against Cuomo so that he could advise his brother on how to beat those charges. The reason he was fired was not that he helped his brother. If he had just in his private life stood by Andrew, I don't think anybody would bat an eyelash at that.
No.
The issue is that he used his standing as a journalist to try and influence the course of events and keep his brother in power, which is unethical.
Yeah, I was just about to say, it's almost like Tucker is wildly mischaracterizing the concept of defending your brother here.
Yeah, and it's like it. And this is going to come back later because I do think it's interesting and just how vociferous Tucker is about this, that even if they're loathsome, you help your brother. Like, what's to exactly what extent? I mean, this might be nitpicking again, but honestly, Tucker, like, if my brother committed murder, do I stop helping him at that point? What if, like Andrew Cuomo, my brother committed sexual assault? Do I stand by him and help him out? Like, I love my brother to death, and I wouldn't help him out in those cases because he did a bad thing and deserves consequences, you know?
Yeah. The loyalty thing is like a red flag to me. That strikes me as kind of fashy. Like, loyalty above all else to, like, your family or to your in-group or whatever. That strikes me as not good. Because, you know, Trump's first few months in office, he like told the FBI director that loyalty is the most important thing, you know? So saying loyalty is more important than anything makes red flags go up, you know?
If my brother did something horrible, I would still love him, stand by him in personal life, try to help him however I can, but I wouldn't use my podcast to try and cast aspersions on the charges against him. And like, it's not a perfect one-to-one comparison, but that's essentially what Chris Cuomo was doing. It makes absolute sense for now. We're trying to maintain its reputation for integrity to fire that guy, you know?
Yeah. Another thing, I don't like the idea that like you have to be loyal to your family on the virtue of them being your family. I think that if your family disrespects you, you have no obligation to them.
Yeah, because that's a very toxic trap a lot of people fall into is, well, they're my family.
Like, well, are they hurting you all the time? Then maybe stop.
Yeah.
Stop letting them do that.
So Tucker brings on Jason Whitlock to talk about this. He hosts a show on the Blaze Network, which is a Glenn Beck's network.
He's perfectly fine.
Yeah, we've met Whitlock before. He's the Alphabet Mafia guy.
Okay.
And he has not updated his takes in the week since we last saw him.
Jason Whitlock is the host of Fearless. We're happy to have him join us tonight. Jason Whitlock, I cannot believe I'm opening this show with you offering a kind of defense, maybe not of Chris Cuomo himself, who I do not like, but of his priorities. When you are called upon to help your brother, no matter what he's accused of, you help because he's your brother. Am I missing something?
Tucker, you're not missing anything at all, but I've got a completely different take on this in terms of what the overall lesson here is for both Cuomo brothers. They are the wrong complexion and they're heterosexual for the time that they're living in. And they're finding out you can't be woke enough. And the Cuomo brothers have tried to play the woke game, but they're in the same crosshairs as every other heterosexual man in this country. And so given an opportunity to move on from Governor Cuomo and replace him with someone else, the state of New York did that. Given an opportunity to replace Chris Cuomo now because he's defending his brother and he somehow has run afoul of the Me Too movement, of feminists, and just the whole, in my view, the Alphabet Mafia. He doesn't fit the right profile. And so they're going to replace him with someone who does fit the profile. This whole diversity, inclusion, and equity, D-I-E, die.
Whoa.
Oh, God. That was worse than I was expecting it to be. What does the Alphabet Mafia have to do with, like, not defending a sexual assault suspect.
Yeah, it's very dumb. Whitlock's interpretation of events seems to be that the reason that Andrew Cuomo had to resign as governor and Chris Cuomo got fired from CNN is because they're straight white guys, not because they did bad, unethical, and illegal things.
Yeah, that are like mostly unrelated to sexual minorities, unless raped is a sexual minority, which not exactly.
I will say, though, like this whole time, I thought that Jason Whitlock was an idiot, but I'd never considered that diversity, equity, and inclusion, if you take the first letters, spells out die. So I think he's onto something.
Oh, God.
And then Tucker drives the point home one last time, just to really illustrate that he means it.
Once again, it's not a defense of Chris Cuomo or his awful, loathsome brother. But when your brother's in trouble, you help your brother. Period. Because that's who you're loyal to. Period.
I wonder how many bodies Buckley Carlson Sr. has under the floorboards that Tucker knows about.
Really hammering the loyalty thing home.
Yeah. So then from here, Tucker dovetails back into Omicron talk. We aren't going to deal with much of it, but there are a couple of points here I wanted to hit.
By now, you've probably heard of the terrifying new coronavirus variant that has left the continent of Africa a smoldering husk of human misery. Experts are calling it the Omicron variant, Omicron being a Greek term that apparently means history-ending apocalypse. Even in Africa, part of the world sadly familiar with suffering, Omicron is like nothing the authorities have ever seen. Consider the nation of Botswana, a landlocked country in southern Africa about the size of France. Yesterday, officials there reported that two people may possibly have died from the Omicron variant. Now, it's true that many more people in Botswana died yesterday from malaria, AIDS, diarrhea, drowning, car crashes, choking on peanuts, domestic disputes, agricultural accidents, and also just because in the end, human beings tend to get old and die. Statistically, that is a valid observation. But it does not lessen the existential terror the rest of us feel knowing that Omicron exists. No, it certainly doesn't.
So I have to fess up, Tyler. I admit that I did not look into whether or not more than two people died of choking on peanuts in Botswana the other day. So
Troy, what about your journalistic integrity?
So I have to give Tucker that one by default. I'm sorry. I know I let the audience down.
This is another one of those times where Tucker like almost has a good point. How we kind of only care about some of the tragedies that happen to humans because of like arbitrary borders on the planet.
Yeah. It's one of those things where he brushes up against a decent argument and then takes a hard right turn.
Yeah, and like you said, what like those things are problems, malaria and all that other stuff he said. So what should we do about it, Tucker?
Right. Yeah. Because his takeaway is just like, oh, yeah, people die. Get over it.
Yeah. Like why? That's not an idea. That's just the world sucks.
Yeah, so he goes on about Omicron a bit, and my position is still kind of the same as when we talked about it Monday, which is that like there's just not a lot of solid information to point to yet, so I don't want to spend a lot of time trying to fight Tucker's conjecture with whatever other conjecture I found. It's just it's not a fruitful endeavor. But in the midst of this report, they get a Fox News special alert because apparently the Washington Post reported that officials in the Biden administration are debating a mandatory 7-day quarantine for people who arrive in the United States from outside the country. And so he was already bringing on Glenn Greenwald for the next segment. But since they got this breaking news, he has to ask Greenwald about his take on that.
Oh, fuck Glenn Greenwald.
I figured, like, normally I skip the Glenn Greenwald segments because he's so annoying.
Yeah.
But I figure it can be either or. We can listen to Candace or Greenwald.
Glenn Greenwald is an independent journalist. We've got a couple of things to talk to him about, but we just want to invite him, welcome him now. Thank you for joining us, Glenn. So what is your reaction to 7-day quarantine? As an American who lives abroad, what's your reaction to this?
I was just thinking about that, that I have several trips planned. And it is hard to express or put into words how divorced the discourse around COVID is in the United States from the science that we were all supposed to follow. If you have a negative test, if you're vaccinated, what conceivable justification is there for even considering such a grave deprivation of liberty as forcing you for 7 days to lose the core freedom of movement over a virus that we're told there's an effective vaccine for? I feel like we're being trained to simply accept the assertion of any authority in the name of safety without even questioning it any longer.
Well, that's exactly right. What is the appropriate, as a citizen, what is the appropriate response to a demand like that, do you think?
I do think that at some point there's going to have to be a serious show of collective civil disobedience. There's really no way to resist assertions of government power that become abusive except by citizens banding together and refusing to obey them any longer. They cannot force people to do that if that happens.
I agree with you completely on that.
Tucker Carlson, lover of mass displays of civil disobedience.
Also, since when is Tucker in favor of like freedom to move across the border?
he's mad that American citizens might have to quarantine if they travel abroad. But as if we're talking about people of other nationalities coming here, he doesn't want them here in the first place.
Right. So,
it's a mess. And I was just really frustrated with their like, yeah, the way out of this is with protest and civil disobedience, when Tucker has spent the last at least year deriding protesters as looters and thugs.
Yeah.
Then he's got to dovetail into what he actually brought Glenn Greenwald on to talk about.
So I have to ask you about this Fauci story. So of all the things that people criticize Fauci for, the one that enraged The Washington Post most is when a nonprofit organization demonstrated that Fauci had supported cruel and probably scientifically pointless experiments on dogs, and the Washington Post promptly attacked the group that exposed this. Why would the Post be so quick to defend cruel and needless experiments on beagle puppies?
Here's the bizarre thing about this, Tucker. So there's this animal rights group that has done an ingenious strategy called the White Coast Waste Project. They have joined the left and the right in Congress by fusing the cause of animal rights and dog cruelty to wasteful taxpayer government expenditures by saying that the government is using our taxpayer dollars to fund medically unnecessary, gruesome experiments. They have been denouncing this for years. They have been praised by the Washington Post from 2016 through 2020 as one of the rare success stories in Washington of a bipartisan coalition. Suddenly, they prepared a hit piece on them. Why? Because the focus of the activism is the fact that these experiments, which are not just gruesome, but totally unnecessary, is being overseen by agencies controlled by Dr. Fauci and funded by Dr. Fauci. And the Washington Post is willing to protect the government and these gruesome experiments, all to prevent any criticism from being attached to Anthony Fauci. It is a complete abuse of journalism to attack this small nonprofit group that has a great cause simply because their work might reflect on someone who's now an icon of liberal journalism.
Man, that is the depth of corruption right there. But you're right. It's counterproductive because they've certainly won my support and I think of many people listening tonight. Glenn Greenwald, great to see you, as it always is. Thanks a lot.
Good to be with you, Tucker. Thanks.
So what they're talking about here is, so what the allegation is that Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which he runs, funded experiments where beagles had their heads placed in mesh cages filled with the diseased sandflies.
Yikes.
Yeah. And there are some photos of this that went around, and it grew into a huge wave of hate toward Fauci. And like members of Congress wrote a bipartisan letter about it, questioning the purpose of the experiments. I actually was able to find a recording of a couple of the voicemails left to Fauci's office resulting from this. I'm going to play that quick.
Thank you, Dr. Fauci. I hope they put you in a cage with a bunch of flies and let them eat you. And then I hope they hang you from the highest tree.
I would like Dr. Fauci to stop using beagles and killing animals to prove his unverifiable points about COVID, his ever-changing little pea brain.
Hey, Fauci, you're one of the sickest, most psychopathic individuals on this planet. And humanity is coming for you. Torturing dogs for your f***ed up so-called science. It will come. There will be Nuremberg 2 when you're done. Because you're a sick, satanic, demonic piece of
f***. Hey, Fauci, you evil f***. I forgot to mention, your demise is self-orchestrated, you piece of shit. You're not going to get away with this. Now you've been exposed, you evil f***. Your days are numbered. Rotten hell, f***.
Strong reaction to this.
Yeah, you could say so.
Fauci's office said that they received 3,600 phone calls in 36 hours after the story broke.
Jesus.
Yeah. Now, here's the issue. It's not true.
What?
The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases did not fund this experiment. It was a real experiment. It took place in Tunisia. But Fauci's organization was not a funder, as was reported by this animal welfare group called the White Coast Waste Project. The White Coat Waste Project itself, what they tend to do, they draw attention to taxpayer-funded studies that involve animal testing. And I think they've done some good work in the past. Like, animal rights are really important to me personally, and I'm totally against exposing like cruelty in animal testing. Like, I'm totally down with that. However, there's some reasons to be a little bit skeptical of the White Coat Waste Project in situations like this. The head of the organization is a former Republican operative, and most of the board members and some of their staffers have worked for Republican members of Congress or the GOP organizations. So, this false claim about the funding for the Beagle study originated with an error by scientists. Initially, the researchers mistakenly listed the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases as a funder when they published a paper in the scientific journal in late July. The journal issued a correction on October 26th when the agency flagged the mistake to the researchers amid the deluge of phone calls. So it was a mistake by which Fauci's organization was incorrectly listed as a funder of this research, and that was retracted in the journal later. It's not true.
Right.
And so when the Washington Post published a piece about how the story was fake, and that's the story that Tucker and Greenwald are misrepresenting here, pretending that it's just out of fealty to Fauci that they need to rush to his defense. Tucker talks a little bit more about COVID, most of which I'm ignoring, but he did say this, which I thought was just infuriating.
Okay, so let's just parse this just for a moment. A fully vaccinated person in California has Omicron and is doing fine. So what can we conclude rationally from this? Well, obviously, the most stringent COVID restrictions in the country are not stopping the spread. Masking, social distancing, nonstop anxiety, talking about COVID from dawn to dusk. None of it worked. And the vaccines didn't work either. The patient in California had two injections and still got Omicron. So maybe the lesson here is viruses are very hard to stop. Sometimes they're virtually impossible to stop because they spread with remarkable efficiency. In the case of coronaviruses, they live in animals. So they're never going away, ever, no matter what. They don't tell you that, but it's true. So given all of those facts, it's possible we would be better off working on medicines to keep those viruses from killing vulnerable people. That seems like a rational approach to the problem.
It sure does, huh, Tuck? Because coronaviruses live in animals, this one's never going away. It's stupid to pretend that it will. So what we should be doing is investing in medicines that prevent the spread and infection of the virus. You know, a fucking vaccine, you douchebag.
Okay, yeah, that's infuriating. What does he suggest? Hydroxychloroquine?
Yeah, he's. I think he's still on. I haven't heard him mention ivermectin in a while, but as far as I know, he's still on the ivermectin kick.
Okay, all right. That is the new one.
Yeah, he had Alex Berenson on this week to promote his new book, Pandemia. And Berenson talked about how there's a new drug from Pfizer that shows promise in treating COVID infections. But then he says, and it is Pfizer, so I almost hesitate to say it. It's like, so you're casting doubt both ways. It's all very frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. Also, he's complaining like lockdowns and masks don't work, but like Almost nowhere I go requires a mask, and they haven't for like a while.
Yeah.
I typically still wear a mask in public places, but like almost no one requires that I wear one. So
yeah. And this is one of the states that took COVID more seriously, and we haven't had any meaningful mandates in months. So
yeah. Yeah.
So then we only have a couple of clips from Wednesday's show. It's mostly more Omicron and Ghislaine Maxwell trial stuff. And then Thursday's episode is mostly about Jussie Smollett, which I refuse to learn about.
Why are we talking about Jussie Smollett again? I guess we're not.
I mean, that's gone to trial now, so that's why Tucker is bringing it up again.
Okay, wasn't it like 2 or 3 years ago that
yeah, it was 2019, happened? And Tucker's take on it is that this is proof that all hate crimes are fake, which I don't even want to engage with right now. So.
Yeah, no.
So we just have a little bit from Wednesday. For example, Tucker gets talking about the January 6th committee. He's mad that they subpoenaed Roger Stone, and he just interviewed Roger Stone about it on Tucker Carlson Today. So he plays an excerpt of that. We're not going to listen to any of it because it's honestly really boring. I was expecting some Roger Stone style bombast, but he mostly just talks about how he was in a hotel room on January 6th. He couldn't have been involved in anything. And when he was in jail before, he found God and he's really religious now. That's most of the interview.
Wow. What a normal, not griftery thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah. But then in talking about the January 6th committee and their various subpoenas, Tucker does this.
Now the committee's decided to shut down one of the most popular journalists on the right, Alex Jones. Yes, journalist. Jones is often mocked for his flamboyance, but the truth is he has been a far better guide to reality in recent years. In other words, a far better journalist than, say, NBC News national security correspondent Ken Delanian or Margaret Brennan of CBS. Alex Jones never bought the Russia hoax, not for a second. And if Jones sat down with Tony Fauci, he would ask him real questions, just as journalists are supposed to do. He wouldn't just slobber all over him. But Alex Jones makes fun of Joe Biden, so the January 6th committee is threatening him with prison. Now, the irony here, and there are many layers of irony here, but the main one is that Alex Jones isn't simply innocent of inciting crime on January 6th. Alex Jones actively worked to prevent crimes from taking place on January 6th. We're not running interference for Alex Jones, and we're not guessing about it. We happen to know this for a fact because we looked into it in some detail for Patriot Purge. It's our 3-part documentary series on Fox Nation. Here are the facts.
Yeah, so he plays that clip from Patriot Purge where Alex Jones has a megaphone and he's telling people not to fight with police because they're going to make that the story.
Yep, and so that he has plausible deniability.
Yeah. So I know that a lot of our listeners don't need to be told this, but there is maybe no worse guide to reality than Alex Jones.
Correct.
And like, I guarantee Tucker has never listened to the fucking Alex Jones show. Are you kidding me? There is nothing resembling reality on that show. If you're one of our 10 listeners that haven't listened to Knowledge Fight, they have like 700 episodes worth of receipts.
Yeah. And like, is the trial still going on? Like because he settled in the case against him for like defamation against the kids that got shot in Sandy Hook.
Yeah. So that's interesting. He didn't settle. He lost via default judgment because he refused to participate with the process at all. And he was so obstinate and impossible to work with that the judge ruled he'd essentially forfeited his right to a defense. So,
wait, you can just do that?
It's so exceedingly rare that it's taught as like a hypothetical in law schools. It's like something that could happen but never happens. And that happened to Alex twice in 2 separate Sandy Hook cases.
Why is that allowed to just go on? What? March him in there in handcuffs if you have to. Fuck, I don't care.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And like, there's a sense in which it might be better because now Alex isn't gonna like get to take the stand and be a blowhard and perform for the cameras.
Kind of feels like what this is.
Yeah, but he's Alex Jones and Roger Stone were both subpoenaed by the January 6th committee to talk about their connection to the events on that day. Alex Jones was involved with Ellie Alexander in at least preparing for and planning the event. So that's what Tucker is mad about now. For his part, Alex Jones has said that he will not comply with the subpoena and doesn't intend to show up. So, you know, it is what it is.
Which should be a crime.
Yeah. I mean, they held Bannon in contempt, so maybe.
Did they jail him for it? Because I'm pretty sure they have the right to do that, and then they never actually do it.
Yeah, I don't believe he has been jailed, unfortunately.
Yeah, please take American democracy seriously, Congress. Why do I have to beg you for this?
Yeah. I've been listening to a couple episodes of Bannon's podcast recently because I don't have immediate plans for it, but at some point I'd like to do an episode about that dude.
And you must hate Joy.
It's a black hole, man. It is dark.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it for a second.
But yeah, when I hear Tucker there going to bat for Alex Jones, what I hear is, I'm going to defend my friend. And it's the exact same thing that we saw a couple of weeks ago with Dave Portnoy and the allegations of sexual misconduct against him. And yeah. Tucker was willing to have him on the show to completely strip that of any context and just prop it up as though it's a big bullshit hit piece.
Yeah.
He's doing the same thing here. And I think that it's not unrelated to when he was defending Chris Cuomo and talking about how your obligation is to your family, no matter what, you help your family, period. I think that this is kind of what we're seeing is Tucker taking that value he has and applying it. I'm going to help out my buddies.
Right.
And just to say it clearly for anybody who's on the fence, parents of murdered children were harassed because Alex Jones claimed that the parents of their dead children were crisis actors. That is monstrous behavior. And it's only one of a litany of monstrous behaviors Alex engages in on a regular fucking basis. And the fact that Tucker is Mr. Family Values, someone think of the children, Tucker Carlson, is so willing to go to bat and call this guy a journalist is gross.
Also, he named those other journalists, and that felt like a whistle to go and attack them. I already forgot what their names are, but
I'm curious as to why he picked those two in particular. I think it might be because they had because the next thing that Tucker said was Alex Jones never fell for the Russia hoax. So I'm thinking that they might have been big Trump Russia collusion voices at that time.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. All I got. So I thought that was a very disgusting display and also illustrative of how Tucker views his job and that it's less important to be accurate and more important to defend the people who you're loyal to.
Yes, loyalty above all moral contempt.
So then we're not going to mess with any more big narratives from the week, but I do have three more clips from, two from Wednesday's show and then one from Thursday.
So as we told you last night, and you may have noticed, CNN pulled its top-rated anchor, Chris Cuomo, off the air for the crime of helping his brother. But you can't just pull someone off TV. You have to let people know ahead of time. Otherwise, you're going to have about a dozen people tuning in and wondering, wait, where's the steroid guy? So over at CNN, the Dwarf King dispatched his eunuch with the news that Chris Cuomo was being pulled off, indefinitely suspended. What's so interesting and tells you so very much about CNN is we learned today that the eunuch himself would like Chris Cuomo's job. Ooh, the betrayal, Mr. Beria. So interesting. So it raises the question, what kind of person is CNN's media critic? We've come across audio that answers that question. So here is, and we're going to use his name for the first time, Brian Stelter, explaining to a group of people that he has fired his nanny, who of course remains nameless, because she refused to get the injection. Listen to this.
You know, me and my wife both work full time. We both make enough money to have a nanny during the day in New York, and our nanny refuses to get vaccinated. And so we are parting ways with her. And it was very, very sad that we thought after 6 months of seeing the vaccines are all good and everybody's fine, that she would come around.
So the headline here is that CNN's media critic blithely dismissed his little non-white servant because she didn't obey. And that is, quote, very, very sad. Well, how sad? How sad was he exactly? Did he pay her health insurance until she finds a new job? What is she doing to eat and pay her rent now that she's been dismissed by CNN's very sad media critic? We don't really care what happens to our servants, do we, when they disobey? So we asked CNN today, of course, we got no answer at all, which is itself an answer, which is we don't know. We don't care. Tells you a lot.
Our servants. Like we've all just got them around the house.
Yeah, yeah. Showing a scar is a little there. And this is just very annoying to me for a number of reasons. One, I mean, Tucker doesn't know that she was non-white. He's just assuming that because she was a nanny.
Yeah, yeah. Way to bring race into this.
Stelter even said in that clip they kept her on for 6 months hoping she would come around. So it's not like, oh, you're not going to get the vaccine. Fuck you. Like, he tried.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't think it's unreasonable to somebody who works with your children every day to not be infected with a dangerous disease.
Yes. It's not unreasonable at all. Also, hey, Tucker, what is your solution to nannies not being protected from healthcare if they get laid off? What's your solution to that?
Exactly. Yeah. And that was what I really wanted to get to.
Theme of today
is that, like, Tucker does not give a shit about the plight of this nanny. It's just an excuse to dunk on Brian Stelter. Yeah. And, like, if he gave a shit about people who didn't have health insurance, he might spend some time on his show advocating for, you know, like, ways to expand health coverage or,
yeah,
you know, solutions to the problems he bitches about.
Yeah, a UBI so that you can't, so you don't lose your apartment when you get laid off or something, you know, that kind of thing.
So then this Tucker takes a brief detour into a narrative that is kind of weird and I think is just a commercial for his upcoming documentary.
If you've been watching what's happening in California recently, you may have asked yourself, how did this happen? How did the prettiest state in the country fall apart? Well, a big part of the reason is Proposition 47. It passed with remarkably little fanfare back in 2014. That initiative effectively legalized property crime in the state. And of course, property crime leads to violent crime, inevitably. That proposition reduced legal penalties for shoplifting, grand theft, forgery, fraud, receiving stolen property, among many other offenses. Now, how did a law like that pass? Who thought it was a good idea to legalize theft? And that would turn out well. Well, in part, it passed because of profound support from California's entertainment industry, from some of the richest people, some of the best protected people in the state of California, none of whom, as far as we know, have apologized for what they did. So tonight, we want to highlight some of the entertainers who were responsible for destroying California. You're going to see a lot of them scroll past you on your screen right now. The list includes Jay-Z, Brad Pitt, John Legend, Alyssa Milano, of course, and needless to say, Michael Moore. In large part because of Proposition 47, which, again, all of these entertainers supported publicly, the state is now collapsing. Businesses are boarded up. They have to be because mobs of organized looters smash the windows. And then, of course, disorder leads to more disorder, which inevitably leads to violence. That is always true. So in 2020, last year, homicides in the state jumped by more than 30%, hit their highest level in more than a decade. Other crimes like robbery are way up. In the city of Oakland, for example, which doesn't need any more disorder, carjackings have increased by more than 100% just this year. None of these crimes are going to get prosecuted. Proposition 47 gave prosecutors the leeway to stop punishing crimes. Now, district attorneys in California, including Soros' handpicked DAs in San Francisco and L.A., are taking advantage of this. So it's complicated what happened to California, but it's not that complicated. The richest people in the state, the people with the most privilege, did the most to destroy it and make it completely miserable and untenable for people who can't protect themselves. That's exactly what happened. And again, you're seeing the pictures on the screen right now. None of them has apologized for it. And every one of them should.
Okay, do rich white people have privilege or not?
Make up your mind, Tucker. Also, Michael Moore was on that list. Were we still at the same college when I met Michael Moore?
I don't know. I don't think I remember you telling me that you met Michael Moore. When
Met might be a strong word, but he called on me for a question when he came to visit our college.
Oh, okay. That must have been the semester I left then, or
yeah, I think it was, because it was my film teacher that hyped it up. He was excited that Michael Moore was going to be there, and that was how I knew about it.
Okay.
Yeah, so in that second to last clip, he was talking about Prop 47 that passed in California in 2014, and he says that that's the reason that California is ruined now, because it legalized property theft. So Proposition 43 was a 2014 proposal. The title of it was the Safe Neighborhoods and Schools Act. And it did not legalize property crime. What it did was made theft with a monetary value of $950 or less a misdemeanor instead of a felony. So here's an overview from the California Courts website. Proposition 47 implemented three broad changes to felony sentencing laws. First, it reclassified certain theft and drug possession offenses from felonies to misdemeanors. Second, it authorizes defendants currently serving sentences for felony offenses that would have qualified as misdemeanors under the proposition to petition courts for resentencing under the new misdemeanor provisions. Third, it authorizes defendants who have completed their sentences for felony convictions who would have qualified as misdemeanors under this proposition to apply to reclassify those convictions as misdemeanors. So, essentially, this was making certain property crimes and drug possession misdemeanors instead of felonies, and allowed people currently serving felony sentences that would count as a misdemeanor under the proposition to apply to have their cases retried, or people who had already served felony sentences to have them changed to misdemeanors on their record.
Okay, so more lenient sentences for nonviolent crime. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and this has been in effect since 2014, so it's kind of weird that Tucker is talking about it now as the reason California is failing, except that he talks about it being a Soros-funded proposition and talks about how Soros' handpicked prosecutors are enforcing it. So I think what he's doing here is just building up the Soros prosecutor narrative he's been in. Because he needs to hype things up because he has that Soros documentary from Tucker Carlson Originals coming out this month.
Okay. What a normal non-white nationalist thing to do.
Yeah, good stuff. I'm perversely excited for that documentary. I think I'm going to have a good time going through it.
I don't blame you.
So we have one more clip here. This is from Thursday's show. Thursday, there was a lot of Jesse Smollett talk and a lot of Alec Baldwin talk, and I don't care about either very much. And then there was some stuff about the Ghislaine Maxwell trial and like, hey, we're learning more about how Epstein was totally close to Bill Clinton, y'all. I don't want to deal with it.
Which no one knew before.
But there is this at the very end that I think we need to talk about.
Well, a bizarre situation recently unfolding on Delta Airlines. We just learned about it. Trace Gallagher, as always, has the very latest. Hey, Trace.
Hey, Tucker. Passenger jets have a backup system called the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System, or ACARS. It allows the crew on board to text crews on the ground about weather advisories, mechanical issues, emergencies, and cattails. Specifically, hairless cattails like this. At the time, a crew member texted this, and I'm quoting here, a passenger in seat 13A is breastfeeding a cat and will not put the cat back in its carrier when flight attendant requested. A bit later, the flight attendant expanded on that statement on social media, saying, quote, this woman had one of those, like, hairless cats swaddled up in a blanket so it looked like a baby. Her shirt was up, and she was trying to get the cat to latch. And she wouldn't put the cat back in the carrier, and the cat was screaming for its life, as would I. No word on what happened to the cat nursing woman when the plane landed, but just for the record, this happened on November 13th in seat 13A on flight 1360. That's not the exact cat, but it's close.
Trace Gallagher, thank you so much for that. Yeah, there are moments we think maybe the Chinese will win, but we're not going to think that. Great to see you. Thank you.
What the fuck did I just listen to? What?
That night. You get 90 Days of Originals at FoxStationTuckerCarlson.com for free. Hope you will. Have a great evening. Here is Sean Hannity with more on the breastfeeding cat. Sean?
All right. All right.
So, they're going to keep talking about it. They're not done.
Every time Tucker interacts with animals on his show, it's the best thing.
Is this the first time since Chicken Lady?
Yeah, I mean, we had the zombie raccoons and the sex-crazed pandas.
Oh, okay. That's true.
And now, breastfeeding cat.
Apparently. Who's Trace Gallagher? Why is he the expert on this? What?
Yeah, he's one of Fox's contributing reporters who brings like breaking news to Tucker's show sometimes. Usually it's about like the border, but apparently they needed to make time for this breastfeeding cat.
Oh, man.
Which I think I'm against, I think.
I don't know. Like, I don't think it's hurting anyone.
Maybe the lady.
I mean, well, I don't know. Like, I'm not in favor of, like, public breastfeeding being against the law because it seems archaic and conservative to, like, not let women show their nipples, but men can. Like, that's just dumb.
Yeah.
I'll admit it's pretty weird that she's doing it to a cat.
On a plane.
On a plane. Yeah, I will concede that's pretty fucking weird. But I don't know if this is the type of thing that you need to make policy over. personally.
Yeah. Before I watched that episode of Tucker Carlson Tonight, I did take a look because on the Tucker Carlson subreddit, they have these discussion threads that where they like talk about the episodes as they're live. I was reading through the thread for Thursday's show prior to watching the episode, and I saw people talking about Titty Cat. It's like, what on earth is Titty Cat? So now we know, mystery solved. You know.
Yeah. Oh, that was good. That was good stuff.
So that's our episode. There is right now, obviously, before the Supreme Court, a challenge to Roe v. Wade. And Tucker talk about that a little bit. I decided to leave it on the table for now because I think it might be easier to talk about once there's like a ruling. And I'm trying to find somebody we can talk to that has a little bit more expertise in the issue. So that's something that I'm keeping an eye on. But yeah, other than that, that was really the week on Tucker's show behind us. And Jesse Waters was hosting on Friday, right. So I didn't have to watch that. Thank God.
Yeah, good news. I was a little surprised. This is close to home, but I'm surprised that the Oakland shooting didn't come up.
Yeah,
because they're like charging that kid with terrorism.
Yeah, like his parents are involved. I mean, not involved. Yeah, but like they are implicated.
Yeah, they're charging them with something. And I don't know. I'm interested to see where that goes, but I'm surprised Tucker didn't jump to defend the school shooter.
Yeah, that is interesting now that you say it.
Because it's like calling him a terrorist is like the kind of thing that Tucker hates.
Maybe he senses that one's radioactive though, because like it is clear that this kid killed a lot of people. Or
yeah,
I guess at least people. So I don't know.
Maybe he's learning from Alex Jones that you shouldn't talk about dead minors.
Excellent guide to reality, Alex Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, Alex Jones talks regularly about how like people he sees in the supermarket transform into demons and growl at him. So Whatever.
But he's not on any drugs. He swears.
So, Tyler, what is our sworn enemy?
How about kids pretending to be Arctic mammals? That they seem to be destroying the country.
I like that. This has been Tuckered Out, sworn enemy of kids pretending to be Arctic mammals.
Yeah, that's the very real problem in this country, yeah.
All right, and we will be back with more of that business next week. But in the meantime, we do have a website. It is tuckeredoutpod.com.
And we're on Twitter at tuckeredoutpod.
And we have a Facebook group, which is Wokeristas.
And we are also on Patreon. Thank you to all of our lovely patrons once again.
And feel free to email the show. We love hearing from you. It's tuckeredoutpod@gmail.com.
Yes.
We had a listener recently make us some awesome fucking artwork that I'm really excited for. Our listeners are great.
Yes, you're all lovely.
And we will see you all next week. In the meantime, don't watch Tucker's show. I'll do it for you and try to enjoy your life.
Thanks for listening.
Buck up. It's going to get better.